morning. Senator Swedzinski, if you're ready, we will begin. No more potty talk over there. No more potty talk over there. We heard you talking. Anyways, not inappropriate. No. All right, good morning. It is Tuesday, March 18th, 2025, and a quorum is present. This is the Minnesota State Education Finance Committee, and we will now come to order. I want to start today by thanking all of those that attended Sovereignty Day yesterday and listened to our tribal leaders, so those that participated and shared so much good information about this population of folks in our communities, not only in rural Minnesota, on the reservations, in the cities, the towns, but also our large urban core. They make up a large percentage of our children in our public schools. And so thank you all for participating in whatever way that you did. Today we're going to hear from two of the tribal contract schools in the state, and then we're going to hear five bills that are related to Indian education and our tribal contract schools. So I hope you're all listen in very carefully and think of good questions. We are going to start today by hearing from Dan McKeon. He is the school director at the Bago Nagishing School. And if Dan would like to come on screen, unmute yourself. I think there is a PowerPoint presentation that Mr. McKeon is going to present. There it is, and you should have a copy in your packets as well. And so, Dan, when you are ready, if you'd like to come on screen and present.
Good morning. Can everybody hear me?
Yep.
Great. I'm trying to use my video, but it doesn't seem to want to work. Well, there we go.
There you are.
Good morning, everybody. Miigwech for the invite to share some information with you today. I'll try to be efficient about this, but I want to start by giving people a little bit of context about our school, who we are and where we are. If you've ever traveled to Bena, Minnesota, or to somewhere near Lake Winnebogoshish, then you've been close to the Bago Nagishing School. We are about halfway between Grand Rapids and Bemidji on Highway 2. And just so I don't forget to say this later, if you're ever traveling on Highway 2 between those two towns and you want to stop in for a visit and a tour, we would be happy to have visitors. I got asked to do this yesterday, and so it's been a quick process of putting something together. But I want to start by sharing some information about what BIE schools are. We have 183 of these schools across the United States. The bulk of them are located in the upper Midwest or the Southwest. We have four of them in Minnesota. Sounds like you're going to hear from two of us today, which is great. Some of these schools are residential, some are not. Many of them are quite rural in their location, and many of us are quite a distance from any urban center. If I want to get a sandwich for lunch, I have to get in my car and drive about 5 miles down the road before I get to Bena, Minnesota. Probably one of the best comparisons I can make to help people understand BIE schools is that the Bureau of Indian Education, in this sense, serves in a similar fashion to the Minnesota Department of Education, in that they are the agency through which funding flows, and we also report to them with our school data, and they also attempt to support the schools in a similar fashion to the Department of Education. Another thing you'll find familiar is the way that our schools are governed. We have a publicly elected school board. The Leech Lake Reservation is divided into three districts, and we have publicly elected representatives from each of those districts who serve on our school board. We meet the second Thursday of every month at 4:30, and as the superintendent, I report to that school board just like any superintendent anywhere else. So let's talk a little bit about why these schools exist. And to do that, we can kind of look at the origin story of the Bugganegijik school. So the slide that you see right now is a picture from 1975 when the school first started. So what was happening in 1975 is the districts in this area were really doing a pretty horrible job of serving Leech Lake students and Native students. Coursework did not reflect who these kids were. And there were, for example, there weren't Ojibwe language classes or culture classes or Native history classes or classes that focused on the seasonal activities that are at the core of the Leech Lake people. And so in 1975, in protest to this, there was a walkout that happened out of the Cass Lake school system. And the group of people you're looking at in this picture, many of them were a part of that walkout. And in fact, if you look at to the far right, you'll see a gentleman. He's at the farthest right edge of the picture. He was one of the teachers that walked out with the students, and he has been with the school ever since. So he's still working with us today in our 50th year, which is kind of an amazing story. The point of the reason the Bugganegijik school got started was because these families, the staff and the students, wanted a school system that reflected the life, the values, the culture of the Leech Lake people. And so starting in 1975, a small group of people got this going, and between 75 and 83, the school kind of bounced around in different locations, mostly on the western side of the Leech Lake Reservation. And then in 1984, a permanent school was built, and that's where I'm sitting right now. And it's located smack dab in the middle of the Leech Lake Reservation. So if you're driving down Highway 2, it really seems like we're a school out in the middle of the woods, and we most certainly are. But it's also there for a reason, because it was right in the middle, and it gave every Leech Lake kid access, kind of equal access to attending the school. So Bugganegijik today, here's just a picture from a recent picture. We are a tribally controlled school, and so the BIE schools, the 183 schools that I mentioned across the nation, can be divided into two categories. They're either bureau operated or tribally controlled. And most are the latter. So most schools are tribally controlled, and that includes the Bugganegijik school. We are a K-12 school system. We enroll approximately 200 students. That number goes up and down a little bit throughout the year and from year to year. A couple of things that make us really unique, first and foremost, is the focus on Ojibwe language and culture. So all of our elementary students take Ojibwe language classes on a daily basis. Our high school students have graduation requirements around language and culture. And so on any given day, students spend between 60 and 90 minutes in classes that are focused on language and culture. We also have an immersion program. It's called Nagani, and it's a K-6 program. And so when students start here in kindergarten, they can kind of choose one of two paths, either Nagani or the Bugganegijik Elementary School. And Nagani is an immersion program where we work to, obviously immerse kids in Ojibwe language throughout their school day. Another thing that's really special about our school, and this picture captures it well, is the role that elders play. So in this picture, you can see what we call him FUD, but his name is Dan Wilson, reading to some of our students. And Dan sits at the entryway in the morning and greets kids, he's kind of the Bugganegijik grandpa for a lot of the elementary kids who come in and look forward to seeing him every day. And so we try to have elders throughout our school who can support kids and just serve in a variety of roles in the school system. Another thing that's unique is our transportation system. Probably all four of the tribally controlled schools would make this argument that we have the largest transportation district in the state of Minnesota. We travel up Highway 89 towards Red Lake. We go almost as far east as Grand Rapids. We go south of Walker, and we go as far north as almost Black Duck. And so we have an absolutely enormous transportation system. We're sort of notorious for being a school that will close early and often when the weather is bad, and that's because of how far our buses travel. We have students who ride for 90 minutes one way to attend school here. Another thing that I want to mention that makes us unique is a team that we've built here over the years, our student support team. I'm going to get to some of the challenges we face here in a little bit, but we have a very robust student support team here that works really hard on a daily basis to support our kids and help get their needs met, whether those are social needs, emotional needs, or academic needs. So I know the focus of this hearing is on funding. I wanted to give a little context before we got into the funding information, but this is the funding in a very kind of painted in a very broad stroke. The school takes in 25 different funding streams, some of them small, some of them large. Most of them are federal or local, and by local I mean funding that we receive from the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe to fund certain programs like some of our extracurricular programs are directly funded by the Leech Lake Band. But most of our dollars are federal dollars that come through the Bureau of Indian Education. And we get, the acronym is ISEP, Indian Student Equalization Program dollars. And those are kind of the equivalent to MARS dollars. So it's a per pupil funding formula that the BIE uses to determine funding. Now, something that's really unique is that through that federal funding source, for students who are enrolled members of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, we get more money than students who are not enrolled members of the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. And not all students are able to be enrolled. There's a blood quantum that's involved there, which is a controversial thing. But for students who are enrolled, we get a different funding level than students who are not enrolled. In fact, there are BIE schools across the nation who won't enroll students unless they are enrolled tribal members because of that. We also compete for grants that are through local philanthropic organizations to fund some of the programs that we really depend on to be a successful school. And I know people in your positions probably hear this all the time, but we are in a situation where our funding levels generally don't match the level of need that we have. A couple more slides. So wanted to share some of the challenges we face as a school, and probably one of the biggest things that we contend with here at the school on a daily basis are just the trauma-based needs of our students, which all got compounded by the pandemic. And so we really have to take a holistic approach to educating students here, and we have to think about how can we meet some basic needs. So for example, we have in our school, in the fall, we have a dental clinic that we get set up every fall so that students can receive dental health services. We have an eye doctor who sets up here. And so we make sure that kids are getting those needs met. And then on top of that, it's, you know, also teaching them to read and all the things that we associate with schools. Absenteeism is a big challenge that we face with our students. A lot of our students would meet the federal definition of chronically absent, which means attending school 90% of the time or less. But there's a lot of reasons behind that. The history of public education in this part of the state, boarding school history. There's a lot of our students who have family members who had very negative experiences in the public school system, or even worse experiences in boarding schools. And so it's oftentimes our job as educators to convince families that their kids will be safe and cared for in our school system. And then once we can do that, then attendance starts to improve. But we do battle a tough history of education for Native people when it comes to convincing them that we're going to be a good, safe, healthy place for them. And of course, the pandemic in 2000 didn't help that at all. And what that absenteeism leads to is learning loss. And so we have, we can have a classroom where we have really big gaps between, say, our third grade classroom. We might have kids who are reading at a fourth and fifth grade level and kids who are reading at a kindergarten level in that same room. And so that can make instruction challenging. A couple of things that are really unique to Bug and Aggieshig that we face right now. a couple of years ago, we voluntarily agreed to some water testing that kind of went above and beyond the typical public water testing. And PFAS, which are forever chemicals associated with 3M, were detected at levels that were unacceptable, and so we had to shut down our water system. And right now, you can't drink out of our water fountains. We can't use the water that comes out of our tap for cooking or cleaning. And so we bring in lots and lots of 5-gallon jugs of water every week and operate that way. And we're in the midst of a pretty intense project of identifying a new clean water source at our school and then building the plumbing infrastructure to get that water from where it's been located to the school. So that's a unique thing for us. And then another challenge is staffing. We've really worked hard over the years to attract and retain high quality staff, but being where we're located, like I live in Bemidji, for example, and I drive about 35 miles to work each way. And that's a very typical scenario for many of our staff. Many of us travel 30 to 45 minutes one way to be here. And so it can be hard to compete with other districts locally when people live, you know, it's easier to work in Bemidji when you live in Bemidji. And convincing people to make the trip can be a challenge. So those are some of the challenges we face. But I wouldn't be doing a good job if I also didn't talk about some of the accomplishments that we've had here at the school recently. We have a really big project underway with our reading program coming out of the pandemic. We realized that our graduates and just students kind of across the board generally were a number of years behind their peers in their reading levels. And so with a pretty big sense of urgency, we attacked that problem. And now we've got a really strong reading program happening, and we're getting kids back to grade level with their reading levels. The theory here is that if we can get kids to be successful readers, they're going to feel more successful in school across the board. And that's going to lead to, you know, when you feel successful in school, you want to attend school. And so we see it as an antidote to the absenteeism that we're challenged by. I mentioned earlier, we have a strong student support team here. On any given morning, if you were to walk in our school, you would see a team of adults standing in the doorway, greeting kids as they walked in, kind of getting a read on kids and how they're doing that day. And we have a school social worker, we have a school counselor, we have a homeschool liaison, we have a couple behavior interventionists who all work to support kids on a daily basis. And so it's a pretty rewarding job, but it's also a very demanding job. As mentioned a couple minutes ago, it's a challenge to attract and retain staff, but I think over the past few years, we've really seen our rate of turnover go down. And we've actually been able to hold on to teachers. The Bugganegishik School in the past has kind of been a stepping stone for a lot of educators. They would come here and work for a year or two and then get hired by Bemidji or Grand Rapids or one of the bigger districts. But through reworking our salary system, we are now able to offer competitive compensation. And with our small class sizes and some of the other perks of working at the Bugganegishik School, we're able to keep people here. And then the other big thing, and this is an ongoing project, but we really want to be a community school where kids can get whatever it is they need in order to be able to sit down and focus in a classroom. And that might mean a trip to the dental clinic. It might mean a trip to the eye doctor. We have behavioral health services on campus, and we just try to, you know, we serve 2 and sometimes 3 meals a day. And so we try to do everything we can to meet the needs of the kids so that they can be successful students. And the last thing I want to say, just to circle back to the funding topic, there's some services we provide here that are I would call them sort of extraordinary and go above and beyond what you would find in a lot of schools. And an example I'd use for that is our mentorship program. So we have a program where it's an opt-in program for staff, and it's an opt-in program for students and families. So we have teachers who serve as mentors in the program. We have support staff who serve as mentors. Anybody who is employed by the school can serve as a mentor, bus drivers, custodial staff, whoever it is. And then students also can opt into this mentorship program. And what it means is that they will be paired with a staff member who will, on a weekly basis, check in with them, sit down and have a conversation, take a look at the grade book, take a look at attendance records, but also just check in with the kid and see how they're doing. And then that same mentor also makes a weekly contact with the home and talks to parents or guardians about how things are going at school, checks in to see if there's anything we can do to help with something like attendance. And we compensate people for that because they have to do it outside of their normal teaching hours. And so it makes their workday longer. And it's a program that's really starting to help with our attendance. It helps families feel connected to the school. It helps kids feel like they've got an advocate here. And it's something that I personally believe can really go a long ways towards getting kids to attend school more regularly and therefore achieve at higher rates. And it's something that's hard to find funding for. And so I'm on the hunt for competitive grants that that I can submit and hopefully make our case and win some funding to sustain the program. So that's a good example of a program that we really need, but that's hard to find funding for. So with that, I've covered my slides and happy to turn it over to somebody else or to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Director, for that really great overview and the efforts that you make to meet the needs of all of your students. I have a question about the water and PFAS. Is it your school or are there other schools in the area that are also dealing with PFAS in their waters?
So monitoring for PFAS is not a standard procedure. So your standard, I'm an English teacher turned superintendent, so I'm not a hydrologist. I'm not an expert on public water sources, but I've learned some things over the past couple of years. And what happened was we could have continued with the standard water testing that has always happened, and the PFAS never would have been detected, and the water I'm drinking out of this mug right now would have come out of a water fountain here at the school. But I think everybody understands that tribal nations and tribal communities tend to have a heightened sense of responsibility for environmental issues. And so when the opportunity came up to do more rigorous water testing, boom, all of a sudden we were testing positive for something that we really don't want in our bodies. And so I don't know this for a fact, but I think most schools haven't tested for PFAS the way that we have.
Oh.
And so it doesn't mean that they don't have it. It just means they might not know that they have it. As soon as we got the test results, we shut our water system down, and we've been operating with water that gets trucked in every week since I think it was 2023.
Wow.
The winter of 2023 when that happened. And so we've been on bottled water for over 2 years at this point. But we do, I mean, there's light at the end of the tunnel. We are far down the road of, so the school sits on an 80-acre campus. We put in a ton of monitoring wells, and we were able to locate a source of clean water that's sits kind of northwest of the school. And so we've identified a source of clean water. We've got a contractor who's been approved to do the project of digging the well and then putting in the infrastructure that will get that clean water from that well to the school. But as far as other schools go, it's they would have to opt into that testing to make that determination. But most schools are on big public water systems attached to a town, so it's a unique scenario here.
Yeah. Does the federal government help pay for that? Because I think it is part of their responsibility to fund, maintain, repair, and replace the BIE schools. So is the federal government helping you with those costs?
It's a pretty good partnership right now between the school, the Leech Lake environmental team, and then folks from the BIE. Now, the BIE is a giant bureaucracy that, you know, the work that has to go in to get the funding awarded can be really challenging, and it can, you know, I want to spend my time working on things like our reading program, but mm-hmm. I have to spend a lot of my time working on things like our water system and trying to get the BIE to fund projects that are really, really critical. So it, you know, one of the things that I've learned, so I'm in my sixth year at the school, and one of the things that I always run into is, who do we answer to? You know, the BIE, we're a school that serves a tribal nation, a sovereign nation. And so in some sense, we have a lot of our own, I can go to the tribal council, I can go to our tribal education department for guidance, but we can also look to state policy for guidance, and we can look to federal policy for guidance, but sometimes those things are in competition with each other. For example, the BIE, through their federal policy, requires our high school students to have 970 instructional hours in a school year, whereas the state of Minnesota requires 1,020 instructional hours for that same group of students. And so there's often times where myself and the school board has to look at the different policies, different requirements, and we have to choose. And we usually choose like in that case, we choose the more rigorous one. And so our students have, you know, we have 1,040 hours, I think, of instructional hours in our academic calendar. So, knowing who to go to and who to go to for what and which policy to follow can be, it's one of the challenges of being an administrator in a BIE school. But yeah, the BIE is responsible for the facilities. It's just that getting them to respond and support in an adequate way. I mean, the high school here was a tin building from about 1984 until about 2018. It was, there were a lot of problems. I mean, I can almost guarantee the folks sitting around the tables in this meeting that it wasn't a school facility that you would have been comfortable having your kids in because of some of the issues that it had. And it took a long, 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 long time before the BIE stepped up and funded the construction of an actual high school, which got opened in 2018. I'm sitting in that school right now. But, you know, it took decades for that to happen. And so it's the BIE, you know, they work hard to support the schools, but I think it's a messy system, I guess, is how I would describe it.
Thank you for that. Any other questions? I have just one more. Would you explain, our non-native kids, non-enrolled kids, enrolled in your school, are they able to join your school as well?
Yeah, so we have, you know, I'd say maybe it's not quite a majority, but close to a majority of our students are enrolled Leech Lake band members. But we also have students who, you know, we're close to White Earth, we're close to Red Lake, and so we have other kids who are enrolled members of Red Lake or enrolled in White Earth, and they attend school here just because they live on the Leech Lake Reservation. And then we have Native students who are not enrolled. There can be a variety of reasons why they might not be enrolled. And so we enroll both enrolled tribal members and Native students who are not enrolled tribal members, but we also enroll students who are not Native. So, truthfully, we don't have many students who aren't Native who attend here over the years, but it has happened and we do enroll them. Sometimes it's just, you know, it's where they grow up and it's who their family members are and things like that. So we take any student who chooses to enroll here for the most part.
Thank you. Senator Clark, you had a question or comment?
A quick comment. Thank you, Chair Kunis. In 2006, I visited your school and went, oh, we need to do some investment. And it's clear that the investment and work that is doing great improvement, and we need to continue that. So this is just a note of thank you to the community for the ongoing work to make this a central part of the greater Bena community. Good work, and continue to let us know how we can help.
Yeah, and I know people don't get up this far north all that often, but truly, if you're ever traveling down Highway 2, stop in. I can give you a quick tour, can meet some of the kids and the staff. Particularly if you're coming through on a Monday or Friday, we have a really, really great opening ceremony on Monday mornings and a closing ceremony on Friday afternoons. The drum comes out, our boys drum and sing, and it's a pretty neat moment at the school. So if you ever get a chance to stop by, please do so.
Thank you. Online we have Senator Uma Verbaden. You had a question or comment?
Yes, just a question as well. I would also love to visit at some point if I'm up in the area. I serve on the Higher Education Committee, and we've heard a lot from Bemidji State about the work they've been doing to try to partner with local schools in the area, especially to get those pipelines for our Native students into higher education. That's one of the areas where we're really struggling with our state attainment goals. So I'm just curious what partnerships you might have with local universities, tribal colleges, anything to highlight for the committee.
Thank you.
So our deepest connection is with Leech Lake Tribal College. We have a lot of students who graduate from here who enroll there. Their basketball team practices here. We have staff who teach in both places, so really strong connection there. And then sort of radiating out from there with Bemidji State University, you know, we occasionally have student teachers who come to us as part of their teacher preparation program. And I think, you know, there's been historically so much staff turnover at this school that I think there's been a lot of good ideas and probably worthy initiatives that have come in and out our doors when people, you know, sometimes programs are carried by a person before they become sustainable and before they become a part of a system. And so I think there's been a lot of that with particularly with Bemidji State University, where things get started and then the wrong people leave and they come to an end. So it's certainly a partnership that we could do more to cultivate and develop. COVID and the pandemic was really, really hard. I know it was hard on every school system. I argue that it was particularly hard for tribal schools. A lot of those projects really took pause for really 2 to 3 years before we were kind of back in operation and back on our feet. Long-winded response. We've got a great partnership with Leech Lake Tribal College, and we could do more with some of our other nearby universities.
Any follow-up? All right. I think we did, at least my team came up and visited your school a couple years ago when we were on one of our school tours, and it was pretty incredible. Not only the layout and the methodology that was being used to meet the needs of those students, but maybe we'll do another swing around the state and stop and visit you at your school. So thank you so much for sharing the great work that you're doing up there. Say hello to the students and the staff, and appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, Miigwech, you guys have a good day.
You bet. Tara Dupuy, superintendent of the Fond du Lac Ojibwe School, if you would like to join us, there she is. And I think you also have a PowerPoint. Members, there should be a PowerPoint in your folder as well. There it is. And if you'd like to just introduce yourself for the record, and you can begin telling us about your school.
Hey, good morning. I'm going to adjust this a bit. My name is Tara Dupuy. I am the superintendent here at Fond du Lac Ojibwe School. Forgive me, this is the first time I've ever had to do this. So I've been the superintendent here since late 2023. I have two students here also who would like to share some things that they wrote down about our school too. So, and thanks, Dan, for sharing about our funding, because I did not include that in our in my testimony here. So, Tara Dupuy, Nindijnikaj, Jaganashimung, Nenabwe Gijigo Kwe Indigo, Awasisi Nindudem, Nagachiwanang Nindunjaba, Niminwenda Mama Ayayan Nungum. My name is Tara Dupuy, and I am the superintendent at the Fond du Lac Ojibwe School, located on the Fond du Lac Reservation in Cloquet. I've worked here for 20 years. I started as an early fives teacher and ended up being an Ojibwe language teacher for most of my time. I'm eager for this opportunity to share with you our important, how important our school is to our tribe and our local community. Our students are bused to school from areas such as Superior, Duluth, Cloquet, and as far as Kettle River. And last year, we even had students from Hinckley. 98% of our school community receives free and reduced lunch, so we serve them free breakfast and lunch, and 30% of our students qualify for special ed services. The Fond du Lac Ojibwe School serves 140 students this year, providing education starting with our 3 to 5 year old WAJ immersion program. We also have a families and child education based program and our K-12 program with 15 to 20 students. We graduate 15 to 20 students per year, and in 2025-26 school year, we're planning to incorporate an immersion kindergarten classroom. Our school provides Ojibwe language to grades K through 12 for 50 minutes each day, and our students are required to have at least 2 years of Ojibwe language to graduate. Some of our students even participate in Ojibwe Quiz Bowl competitions every year through going to different reservations and competing about history and knowledge, knowledge of Ojibwe language. To complement our language and culture, we start our school year with a community back-to-school feast, incorporating foods from our school community garden. In the fall, our students celebrate Doug Wagon by participating in harvesting, parching, and winnowing the rice they gather. We have drum, we sing and dance at our annual Poki Pero powwow. In the winter, we celebrate with a baboon festival and end the winter camping with our staff and staff from Fond du Lac Natural Resources. They celebrate spring by tapping trees, collecting and boiling sap into syrup and sugar cakes, and we also have our Ziguan spring celebration. We end the school year with our final celebration, or Gmon races, located at Kiwaint's campground on Big Lake. During each celebration, we invite our community and families to provide seasonal demonstrations or to assist with the festivities and to feast and celebrate with us as we prepare in the activities. In addition to our community celebrations, we have two unique agreements with our local Cloquet School District. One agreement allows our students and Cloquet Public students to attend sports at either school. At Fond du Lac Ojibwe School, we currently offer volleyball and basketball. The second agreement allows our high school students in grades 10 through 12 to attend career technical education classes, such as carpentry, welding, commercial driver's license classes for credit. We currently offer our school programming, which we first started with a 21st century grant for cultural classes such as beading, drumming, or ribbon skirt and shirt making, Ojibwe language, and even academic help credit recovery. This program offers students who may not participate in sports a safe and enriching place to connect with their peers. 2 years ago, we also implemented restorative practices and have a group of high school ambassadors that help students work through conflicts with others to restore positive relationships. I could continue to speak about all the positive programs we offer and students and community, but in this current administration, I'm concerned that we're facing some unforeseen challenges. Without funding for these essential programs, we will most likely be cut. Currently, we face obstacles such as being able to offer competitive salary to hire special education teachers and licensed high school teachers for subjects like math and science. Our students' absenteeism has improved through incentives. However, our students' absentee has improved through incentives. However, our students have faced challenges that other public or private school students do not endure. Some families are homeless. Some students need to stay home with sick siblings so their parents can work. Our students are disproportionately affected by incarcerated or addicted parents and are often raised by grandparents, immediate family, or are in the foster care system. We offer school-linked mental health therapy, but are short 3 therapists and our waiting list is extensive. We do our best to hire staff who reflect our student body to foster a sense of belonging and understanding of our language and culture, but finding licensed Native teachers and staff is another hurdle we face. Currently, we collaborate with Native teacher training programs at Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College, but we are often overlooked when they graduate and are applying because we cannot always match the salaries offered by other schools. In closing, I thank you for listening. I hope we are able to continue to serve our students well. And I also have 2 students here that would like to talk a little bit. The first one will be Bella Fernaris.
Bella, would you please introduce yourself for the record, and then you may begin.
Hi, my name is Bella Fernaris, and I'm a junior here at Fond du Lac Ojibwe School. Public schools, in my opinion, offer less opportunity for Native American students, causing them to have lower performance and struggle in school. I was in and out of public schools growing up, and I struggled tremendously. I was a failing student who never wanted to come to school, and I never felt welcome to try out for extracurriculars or sports. I came back here to Fond du Lac at the beginning of the year to hope things would get better, and it did. I'm now the student council president, and I feel more comfortable doing extracurriculars. In tribal schools, they integrate the Ojibwe culture, which makes it seem more welcoming to our students, and they understand family dynamics better and understand the intergenerational trauma that our people have been through.
Thank you so much, Bella, for your testimony, and we wish you well as president of the student council. Next, we have Kenny. Kenny, if you would like to introduce yourself for the group, and you can begin.
My name is Kenny Bosco, and I'm in eighth grade here at FDR Ojibwe School. Thank you for listening today. I attended Cloquet Public School. I like meeting new people, but I was always on restrictions, so I decided to come back to FDR Fond du Lac. I like it here because it's less complicated, and I get help when I need it. Here at FDR Ojibwe School. The most I like here is beading, sewing, and other cultural stuff. We are now working at Sugar Bush collecting sap. Thank you for listening. Thank you again for listening to me.
Thank you very much, Kenny. Members, do you have any questions or comments either for Superintendent Dupuy or the students? All right. Oh, Senator Swadzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. You mentioned in your PowerPoint that you tried a few incentives to decrease absenteeism. Do you want to share one or two of those with the committee, please? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Like last year, we really hadn't done anything for students who didn't miss a day of school, and then at the end of the year, we came up with like a little ceremony in our gym, and the two students that had perfect attendance, they both received $100 gift cards. I think another thing that's been impactful on our absenteeism is our Facebook page, believe it or not. We have made shout outs daily for each classroom that has perfect attendance. And it keeps getting better and better. And we do have Check and Connect mentors that work very closely with our families who have attendance issues. And that has been very helpful to have people that are willing to work with our families.
Follow up, Senator? Thank you. Thank you, Director. Anybody else? Well, thank you. Oh, Senator Uma Verbaden, question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Superintendent Dupuy. I know that you mentioned just the barriers that students with incarcerated parents face. Just wondering if you could expand on that, and also knowing where a lot of our facilities are, I'm assuming many of those students are far away from loved ones. I assume that would be a barrier. Anything else that would be helpful for us to know? And I also serve on the Judiciary Public Safety Committee. I've done a lot of work on that. So just curious how it would be helpful in keeping our families connected.
I'll tell you that as far as incarcerated parents, I went to the state to get my notary stamp because we had so many families living with grandparents, and we needed to have the DOPA in place for our BIE records. And so I am now notary public because of all the kids that are living with grandparents and out of home placements. I mean, as far as incarcerated parents, I'd like to say that I would think that we have about 30% of our parents that are incarcerated at one time or another throughout the school year.
Hmm. Well, that's got to be tough. That's got to be really tough.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. If there are no other questions or comments, thank you, for Director, for coming and telling us a little bit about your school, and also to Director McKeon for joining us as well, and the students. We really appreciate hearing from you today.
Thank you. Miigwech.
Miigwech. All right, next members. Next, members, we have a couple of bills in front of us, and so I am going to ask Senator Westland to come take the gavel so that I can present my bills to you.
Senator Kunesh, when you are settled in, I understand you will be presenting Senate File 42. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and present your bill.
Yes. Thank you, members. Senator Kunesh here to share some bills with you. This morning I'm presenting Senate File 42, and this is a bill that deals with suicide prevention in our American Indian community, especially for our youth. In 2019, the Minnesota Department of Health recorded a record high in suicide deaths in Minnesota, nearly doubling the number of deaths since the beginning of the data set in 1999. Within this decade-long incline, that mirrors patterns across the U.S., and it is also noted that American Indians in Minnesota are about 3 times more likely to die by suicide than any other racial group, about 0.5 times greater than the national disparity at 2.5. The Minnesota Department of Health Suicide Prevention Unit and the Minnesota Suicide Prevention Task Force have identified a number of groups of particular concern in our state suicide prevention plan. These groups show higher than average suicide rates. Youth ages 10 to 24, Native American, middle-aged males, Black African Americans, veterans, people with disability, our LGBTQ plus communities, and it is particularly staggering to note that the less dense the population, it seems that the higher and faster the suicide rate is trending. Communities with higher than average suicide rates require specific prevention and intervention methods to impact the goal of reducing these preventable deaths in Minnesota, and it is for this purpose that the Division of Indian Works and their community partners approached me about initiating this bill. And basically what it does is, and it's an open appropriation at this time, but it's a grant to the Division of Indian Work to help develop suicide prevention curriculum. And they will develop and pilot a culturally specific, because we know that when the approach to addressing these issues are really specific, like for our veterans, for our LGBTQ plus communities, it is most successful. So this bill will, this grant would award the Division of Indian Work to develop and pilot culturally specific suicide prevention curriculum for our Native American youth. And it has to be focused on mental health, emotional intelligence, and depression, and suicide prevention, so that we all understand and they understand the mental wellness and provide practical tools for supporting themselves through these painful times. And this is just a one-time appropriation.
Thank you, Senator Kunesh. Would you like to move your bill before we get to our testifiers?
Yes, I'd like to move Senate File 42 to the committee, please.
And my understanding is this is going to be going to the Committee on Health and Human Services.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, very good. And so we have a first testifier will be Kelsey Yale. Is Kelsey online?
And I'd just like to point out, members, in your packet, there's some information from the Division of Indian Work around this. They're already, there's been a lot of work around this curriculum. And then in your packet is also a document from the Department of Health that talks about preventable deaths by suicide. And so I hope you take the time to also read those.
Thank you, Chair Kunesh.
Oh, and unfortunately, we have Suzanne Nash. Not unfortunately. this is not Kelsey Yale, but we have Suzanne Nash who will be talking to us about this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Nash. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Bonjour, hello, Nian Sen Dichikaz Magazine Donum. I said hello in my language. My name is Suzanne Nash, and I'm a Boys Forward band member up north Minnesota. And I work for Indigenous Peoples Task Force, and I also partnership with Division of Indian Work around cultural teachings, around commercial tobacco prevention and alcohol and drugs. And we've been partnering for a long time. I here today humbly, gratefully, and appreciate all the work that you do. And sometimes come to these things almost feel like an interview. You're nervous. You're like, oh, you got to bring your best to the table and kind of, you know, tell you what you bring to the table. So as I was writing here today, I was thinking about all the work that I've done at the task force for the last 23 years, working with youth around prevention, around alcohol use and drug abuse. And, you know, today we've lost a lot of people due to, you know, the drug epidemic here in Minnesota. And I lost my son as well almost 3 years ago to fentanyl. So I sit before you today and ask you humbly to listen to us when we say that we need to use our cultural teachings as a way to heal from the trauma, as a way to think about identity and who we are. We listen to the schools today talk about, you know, what they need. And we talked about the water and why it's important and why they can't drink the water there. Where we had this issue in Minnesota in Woodbury, Cottage Grove, Lake Elmo, and that's all been taken care of. You know, they sued, you know, 3M for that. So why are, sometimes I think, why are we still dealing with some of this? Why are we still begging for help? Because we need to save our kids. We need to use our cultural teachings because those are our protective factors. That's what helps us. The same way that the churches use the Bible. You practice that. You pray. We use our songs. We use dancing as a way to deal with stress. We take care of the land. We take care of the water because it's sacred. But we, you know, identity is so important, and your culture is so important to knowing who you are and dealing with some of these inequities. We hear this all the time. I'm sure you hear all day long about how, you know, African Americans are impacted and how Indigenous people are impacted, right? And I just, these things are important to us, and we need to be able to reduce the amount of suicide prevention by collaborating together as we are and using those protective factors to help us. And so I gracefully hope that, you know, you take this in consideration. I know the time that we're in right now seems crazy. You know, funding is scarce, and we are worried. And we're worried about what that looks like for that next generation. As you've seen the numbers, you've seen the data, I just really hope that you will think about this as how this impacts all of us, and how do we come together and unite as the same way they might ask you to pledge allegiance to the flag, right? We need to unite together to be able to build generations and build a bigger table, and let us bring our tools to the table that we use, that we know that works. So, miigwech.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Nash. I just want to tell you I'm very sorry for the loss of your son.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, Kelsey Yale? Very good. Please approach, have a seat, make yourself comfortable, and if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Kelsey Yale. I'm a licensed independent clinical social worker. I've worked in a myriad crisis and suicide intervention settings, including county mobile crisis teams, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, now known as 888, or 988, sorry, the Minneapolis 911 Dispatch Behavioral Crisis Response Team, and in the emergency department as a crisis social worker just down the road here. And I'm honored to be a part of this project. Senator Kunesh helped set the stage for this growing problem in Minnesota, but I'd also like to name that from 2011 to 2021, suicide was the eighth leading cause of death in Minnesota across all ages, compared to the 11th leading cause of death nationally. Nationally, suicide is the second leading cause of death for 10 to 14-year-olds, and the third leading cause of death for 15 to 24-year-olds. There are nearly two times as many suicides in the United States as there are homicides. I've safety planned with individuals and families around suicide, done lethal means planning, signed transportation holds due to the inability to mitigate safety risks in the community, and trained crisis responders and conference attendees on crisis assessments, suicide assessments. What I've come to know is comfort talking about suicide is our biggest tool to early intervention. Increased comfort and capacity for conversations about suicide will be one of the many subsequent impacts of bringing culturally specific suicide prevention training into communities across Minnesota. Providing this education to Native American Minnesotans is not only urgently needed to intervene on preventable deaths by suicide within the Native American community, but will also increase each larger community's ability for early detection and intervention on suicidality. The National Strategy for Suicide Prevention, published by the Surgeon General and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, has four strategic directions. The fourth is health equity and suicide prevention. There are four goals within this strategic direction, but I'd like to focus on goal 13, which is to implement comprehensive suicide prevention strategies for populations disproportionately affected by suicide, with a focus on historically marginalized communities, persons with suicide-centered lived experience, and youth. Their report states, populations in the United States disproportionately impacted by suicide include non-Hispanic, American Indian, and Alaska Native youth, middle-aged and older adults, non-Hispanic white males, rural populations, and veterans, among others. More specifically, they name multiple federal agencies, SAMHSA, the NIH, and CDC, support studies in which tribes are strengthening culturally relevant practices in order to reduce suicidal thoughts and attempts, as well as substance use in their communities. Some of these activities include traditional drumming and dance, sweat lodges, the use of native languages, beading, and traditional hunting, fishing, and planting practices to improve food sovereignty. To quote the report on what they believe success looks like, suicide prevention initiatives will reflect the characteristics and circumstances of specific populations, build on their strengths, and address their unique barriers and challenges. This result will be tailored interventions that directly address community need and decrease suicide risk. The following specific example is provided. Native Americans for Community Action identified an ongoing disparity in Arizona. Most of the youth in their community juvenile justice detention center were from two towns on a local Native American reservation. They chose an evidence-based program called Coping and Supporting Training to implement with the schools in these towns. The goal was to help 13 to 17-year-olds manage emotions in healthy ways, make healthy decisions, reduce substance use, and improve grades. Six schools participated in the program. The teachers led the curriculum implementation and received direct feedback and support from the organization throughout the process. Pre and post tests results each have shown improvements in students' self-reported self-worth, coping ability, and school connectedness. This has helped minimize youth risk for entry into the justice system and served as protective factors against long-term suicide risk. A death by suicide not only leaves painful holes in families and communities, it also increases that family and that community's risk for suicide. It has been my honor and privilege to be able to support community members on some of the worst days of their lives. Prevention and intervention are intertwined, and they're both extremely vital to ending these preventable losses. I implore you to support Senate File 42 and help the Division of Indian Work and their partners launch this project. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And then last we'll have Beth Seidel. Please come and make yourself comfortable at the table, and if you could introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Okay. Bujiu, my name is Beth Seidel. My pronouns are she and her. And I am White Earth Band of Ojibwe. I work at Division of Indian Work as a Beat School attendance liaison and a not a number facilitator and trainer. In December of 2020, I graduated from Metro State University with a Bachelor of Science in Human Services. I am currently a graduate student at Metro State University, pursuing a Master's of Science Co-occurring Disorders Recovery Counseling. My graduate program will allow me to become a licensed alcohol and drug counselor and a licensed practical clinical counselor so that I can work with Native youth that are experiencing mental health issues and substance use disorder. I am a two-spirit person, and for those that are not familiar with the term, it means that I walk in both a masculine and feminine spirit. I met my wife in 2009, and in 2016, we had the best wedding ever and got married. I lead with these facts because if things had turned out differently, I would not be sitting here in front of you today with the life that I currently have. Because when I was 17, I'd planned to die by suicide. When I was 17, I decided to tell my mother that I was gay. I didn't think that it was going to be that big of a deal, and I thought, you know, everything would be just fine. However, the opposite had happened. I came out, nothing happened the first night. I came home the second night, and I was bombarded with questions that I was kind of prepared for, but not really prepared for. I was expecting the, well, how do you know? Into that, I had to say, I don't know. I can't tell you how I know. It's kind of like asking a straight person how they know if they're straight. You just know. And so the questions became more and more aggressive. And then at a certain point, the questions stopped. And I started to get comments like, you can't tell anybody. What happens if somebody finds out and they come to our home and they destroy our home? Have you told anybody at school? Have you told any of your friends? Does your sister know? All of these things just kept coming at me and coming at me. And it was at that point that I realized that I had made a huge mistake and that I should not have done what I had done. Because I didn't have answers to her questions. And I couldn't say anything to back up that, like, her safety wouldn't be in jeopardy. Our home wouldn't be in jeopardy. But at that moment in time, my safety was not the highest priority. That night, I made the decision it was too much. I couldn't do it. I didn't want to do it. I went to my room and proceeded to move forward with my plan. Obviously, I'm sitting here in front of you today because at a certain point, I stopped. And I didn't want to go through with it anymore. The next day at school, I bumped into a friend and they noticed that I was kind of off, and then they noticed the bandage on my wrist and asked what happened, and I kind of just shoved it off like nothing, it's not, don't worry about it, it's fine. They went and told a teacher who then pulled me aside and we had a very long discussion about everything that had happened. I'm assuming they didn't make a report or call my parents or anything because nothing happened after that. But the promise is that if I was struggling, I was to go to them and they would help me navigate whatever it was that I navigated. I'm here because this is super important. The work that we're doing and the work that we're trying to push forward so that not only do two-spirit youth, indigiqueer, LGBTQ+ youth have a chance to make it, but also our Native students have a chance to make it farther in life than they think that they should. So miigwech, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much. for sharing your story with us, and I'm very glad that you're here. I don't believe we have any additional testifiers, and I guess before opening this up to members for comment, Many of you have heard me talk about this. My best friend died by suicide in 1991. And when this does happen, it happens to all of the community for that person. And it is so critically important that we find ways, especially for our most vulnerable young people, to find ways to help and support them that are culturally sensitive and specific so that we can save lives. This is really about saving lives. And so that's my comment on the front end, and I want to thank you for sharing your experience here today. Any comments or questions from members? Okay. Senator Kunesh, would you like to share some closing remarks with us?
I think the testimony here today really drove clear the need for culturally specific and unique support systems for this group of young people who are highest at risk. And so thank you for listening. I hope you learned a little something. I hope you think about what you all heard here today. And I would say let's go forward to make sure that our students and our youth are getting the services and the support systems that they need. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator. With that, Senator Kunesh moves that Senate File 42 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The bill passes as recommended. All right, next up, Senator Kunesh will be presenting Senate File 193 today. We will be laying this bill over. Senator Kunesh, would you like to move Senate File 193?
So moved.
Thank you, Senator Kunesh, and please present your bill.
Thank you. Members, we've in the past, and I don't know, we have a few new members here. I don't know how familiar you are with the Permanent School Fund, but Minnesota school trust lands are set aside for a specific purpose. They are set aside to provide continual source of funding for public education. The Department of Natural Resources serves as that trustee for the 2.5 million acres of school trust lands and an additional 1 million acre of severed mineral rights on behalf of Minnesota's public schools. The DNR is tasked with managing these lands in a way that generates revenue for the Permanent School Fund. The interest and dividends from the Permanent School Fund supports K-12 public education and provides funds that are distributed to every public school district within the state. A record $48.9 million was distributed during the 23-24 school year to the school's 329 school districts and 181 academies and charter schools by the Department of Education. That formula allowance for back in 24 was $7,138 per student. All 2.5 million acres of Minnesota school trusts are located within the ceded territories with a small number of pieces within tribal reservation boundaries. In the last 10 years, $327 million have been allocated to Minnesota Public School, and I think that number is higher, these are 24 numbers, from the Permanent School Fund. None of those dollars were returned to the tribal schools, even though 150,000 acres of the highly profitable school trust land is within reservation boundaries. Senate File 193 aims to ensure that those funds are also allocated to students attending tribal schools, whether they are tribal members or not. Over 2,000 American Indian students attend the tribal schools, and we heard from two of them today in the state of Minnesota. And so, members, with that, I have Senate File 193 that would provide Permanent School Fund supplemental aid to our American Indian schools in the fiscal years 26-27. And that is appropriated at $40,000, which I feel is a pretty modest amount. This amount is allocated among the qualifying schools in proportion to the number of students served in each school in the prior year. And with that, Madam Chair, I believe we have Aaron Vandalin, the Director of Minnesota Office of School Trust Lands here.
Thank you, Senator Kunisch. Mr. Vandalin, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thanks.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. Aaron Vandalin, School Trust Lands Director. Recently reappointed, so I have four more years. I came to provide some context on Senate File 193 this morning, and Senator Kunesh beat me to most of it. So I'll just start by saying, for context, this is a continuation of a bill that was heard last year. It was Senate File 4106, and I did testify in support of that bill last year. That bill sought to extend the permanent school fund distributions to four tribal contract schools. That bill did not move forward. There was a compromise last year. There was an appropriation of $40,000 for these four tribal schools. In another part of my job, I actually learned that those schools received that payment in January of this year. So they did receive it, but it took a little bit longer than the other school districts. The other school districts received their first payment of the permanent school fund money or distribution in September, and they just received their second distribution for this school year last Monday, I believe. So this year, school endowment distribution totaled $58 million. I know the Senate research says $57 million. I round up. And that's distributed to all the public schools, as Senator Kunisch said, 320-plus school districts, less than 181 charter schools now, though. I think they lost a few. And it's roughly 600 students that would receive this in the four tribal schools. So, again, this is a continuation of last year. It looks to carry forward the compromise that was last year and extend this until we make further recommendations on how we change the distribution formulas, which is the Permanent School Fund Distribution Task Force that Governor Walz did appoint me to. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, questions or discussion? Senator Farnsworth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The $40,000 number, Senator Kunisch, I was quickly trying to look on the Permanent School Fund's website. Is that about what these schools would receive if they were included in the formula? It seems kind of low to me, so I'm just wondering where that $40,000 came from.
Senator Kunisch?
Yep, that is according to the formula that every other student in Minnesota receives.
Senator Farnsworth, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Kunisch. And I just, I do have one question, and I want to preface it by saying it may surprise some people. I do support this. These are Minnesota kids. They should benefit from the Permanent School Trust Fund. But my question, and maybe it's for Mr. Vandalin or maybe it's for Senate Counsel, looking at the Constitution says the money should go to school districts. I'm just wondering if we do this, will it meet constitutional muster or whatever? I mean, can somebody comment? Again, I want to make it clear that I do support doing this because they're Minnesota kids and Minnesota kids should benefit from this. But I'm just not sure it's constitutional.
We're phoning a friend.
Madam Chair, members, the bill in front of us would appropriate money from the state general fund for distribution of these schools. So technically the amount appropriated wouldn't be proceeds from the from the trust fund.
Thank you, Mr. Arneson. Senator Farnsworth.
Thank you. You just showed that it would have been helpful if I'd have read the whole bill. So thank you for that.
Any other comments or questions from members? I don't see any. Senator Kunisch, any closing remarks?
No, just that I appreciate the support for this bill As we said, you know, most of the dollars that are coming into that permanent school fund are on ceded territories, and actually on some of the many of the acres are on reservation land. It seems only right that those students would receive this modest amount. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kunesh, and this bill is being laid over for possible inclusion. The next bill today is Senate File 1404, which is also a Senator Kunesh bill. This is another bill that we will be laying over for possible inclusion. During testimony and committee discussion, we will also be discussing, along with this file, Senate File 81 and Senate File 349 before laying those bills over. So, Senator Kunesh, if you would like to move Senate File 1404.
So moved.
Thank you, Senator Kunesh. Please present your bill.
Thank you. Members, for years, the call to institutions with Native-themed sports names, mascots, symbols, and gestures has been asked to immediately end their use and to work to understand the importance of Native nations and people to our country and our country's future. In 2024, the Minnesota legislature passed a bill that prohibits public schools from using American Indian mascots, symbols, or images starting September 1st of 2026. The bill applies to nicknames, logos, letterheads, and team names. We've heard today a little bit about the negative impact, the historic impact on the emotional, the social emotional health of our Indigenous communities. And the evidence of this harm from mascots has been demonstrated generationally by the high disparities in rates of violence against Native people, the poor statistics about health and welfare of Native people, including the highest rates of suicide Native youth. And in addition, studies about the effect of mascots on Native youth have specifically identified low self-esteem, low community worth, increased negative feelings of stress and depression as negative psychological effects of Native mascots have on the well-being of our Native youth. And so something so simple as changing a mascot can result in tremendous healing and support kindness, tolerance, and the freedom for all of us. The bill in front of you, or the bill that we heard, depicts or references to American Indian tribes, individual customs or traditions, symbols such as feathers, spears, tomahawks, and indigenous clothing. The bill did allow public schools located within the reservation of a federally recognized tribal nation in Minnesota, where at least 95% of the students meet the state definition of American Indian students. And we had in the past asked schools to obtain an exemption if they wanted to retain their mascots from the nearest tribal nation. And so the bill that you have here in front of you requires a school district to report to the legislature regarding a prohibited American Indian mascot and report to the chairs and ranking minorities of the Education Finance Committee their plans to change. We did change the exemption to modify the process for a public school to seek an exemption to the prohibition. It removes the requirement that the school obtain a consent from all 11 federally recognized tribal nations in Minnesota and the Tribal Nations Education Committee, and requires instead that a public school seek consent from the tribal nation located nearest to the school, and that would be effective immediately upon this bill passing. We are looking to appropriate money to help the schools. We recognize that there is a financial burden to doing this. You know, we would have hoped that schools had in the past done this on their own without us having to legislate it. But we are looking to appropriate money that has not been decided yet in fiscal year 2026 only for the reimbursement to public schools for costs that are that would replace prohibited mascots. It imposes certain administrative duties on the Commissioner of Education to
disperse those dollars once the schools have applied for those reimbursements. And that is my bill.
Thank you, Senator Kunesh. We do have a couple of testifiers. First up will be Brandon Alker. I'm sorry if I said your name wrong.
Alkire.
Can you please introduce yourself for the committee and then go ahead with your testimony?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Brandon Alkire, and I'm the Legislative Director for the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. Our mission at the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council is to protect the sovereignty of the 11 tribal nations to ensure the well-being of American Indian students throughout the state. As part of our mission, we're here to testify and support SF 1404 as this bill balances the interest of tribal nations and the interest of the state. At the core of tribal sovereignty and self-determination is the ability to establish working relationships between tribal nations and the surrounding community which they reside. In this instance, the relationship between tribal nation and the school district for the purpose of a mutual agreement on the use of mascots. We know that working relationships between tribal nations and the surrounding community produces many, many benefits, including economic investments, job creation, and new infrastructure, to name a few, but only through mutual respect, relationship building, and trust factors. The use of Native American mascots perpetuates harmful stereotypes that does not honor Indigenous communities, but rather reduces them to characters. Studies from organizations like the American Psychological Association show that representations negatively impact self-esteem of Native youth. The negative impact contributes to the vast educational disparities like graduation rates. While some believe that mascots are honoring Indigenous people, many Native American leaders and organizations have spoken out against them. True honor comes from listening to Indigenous voices, respecting their perspectives, and making meaningful changes or engaging in partnerships with tribal nations for the use. The removal of imagery that would characterize Native American people in disparaging ways or utilize culture for sports team is a clear message from the state to show that the state values the partnerships built and respects tribal nations. A partnership that has many mutual benefits that impact not just Minnesota, but Minnesotans. Keep in mind, tribal citizens are also Minnesota citizens. They are your neighbors, your friends, and your coworkers. Most importantly, these citizens are part of an everyday social ether. Their kids attend schools with your kids. Their citizens might be your coworkers. They shop at the same grocery stores, and they share the same eagerness to keep Minnesota a wonderful place to live. We, as Minnesotans, and you as our policymakers, have the power to protect our neighbors, our citizens, and our friends from being mischaracterized or harmed by these mascots, and you did, so thank you. Today's legislation is a revision of the current language that encourages relationship building between school districts and tribal nations who reside in proximity of these schools. To be clear, not all mascots are terrible. The point of the legislation is to engage and encourage school districts to work with tribal partners and determine the best path forward. I urge you to vote yes on this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Alkire. Next up, we have Dave Cohen, who is remote. Mr. Cohen, if you can identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
All right. Good morning, Madam Chair, and thank you for this opportunity to speak with you all today. My name is Dave Cowan. Last November, I was elected to serve on the Grand Rapids Area Schools Board of Education, where I now serve as treasurer. And I'm here to share my support for Senate File 1404. A little history. Until 1995, our school district's mascot was simply the Indians. In 1995, the decision was made to replace that mascot based on many of the issues that have been discussed here today. After much consideration, a vote was held here in the community where two options were presented, the Grand Rapids Thunder and the Grand Rapids Hawks. Incredibly, there was a tie. The decision was then made to combine those two options into a fictional bird, and for the last 30 years, the Grand Rapids school mascot has been the Thunderhawks. The current law, as it stands, has been applied inconsistently across the state with a great deal of ambiguity and lack of clear direction. Further, any exemptions to this current regulation empower groups many hours away from our district in the exemption decision-making process. Before we are forced to spend what is estimated at $800,000 in taxpayer funds to change this fictional mascot, one that was developed with no connection to any Native American customs, traditions, or individuals, we'd simply like to have the opportunity to continue our close relation with the closest tribal nation to us, to have that and grant them the authority to grant us that exception and allow the Thunderhawk logo to live on here in Grand Rapids. In my role as treasurer of this great school district, yet a district faced with the need to again cut staff, services, and programs to balance next year's budget, I implore you to pass this amendment. Creating a path forward to allow the Thunderhawks to live on would save Minnesota taxpayers $800,000. As we look at next year's budget, as well as subsequent years' budget projections, I can assure you that we have much better things to spend our limited resources on than the determination, removal, and replacement of a fictional mascot, especially if our local Native American community supports the Thunderhawks. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cowan. All right, member questions or comments? Senator Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A quick question. In the bill, I see we've struck the September 1st, 2026 date for the deadline, and there isn't a replacement. Is it the intention that each school district is given time to make the financial process and work with their local tribes to make this happen?
Senator Kunesh.
Thank you, Senator. Yes, that's exactly right.
Senator Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I appreciate this a lot in the discussions that we've had over the last 2 years. You know, the bill that I have here for the school of ESCO, there are a lot of things that we don't necessarily think about that the school has to do and to deal with. And some of the information that the school gave me, every clock in their school has the Eskimo as the igloo logo on it that would all have to be replaced. Every school uniform, the sign coming into the school, a marker that they had that they used as a fundraising event to pay for the football field, which also would have to be replaced. Tile flooring within the school, the basketball court, scores tables, chairs, wall mats. Upon the passage of this law in 23, the ESCO school board did vote to end using that. But what they're looking at is estimated costs of about $945,000 if they have to replace their basketball court. If they can just sand it down, they're still looking at nearly $800,000. And I think I appreciate the time frame, an extension of the time frame, and some potential funding from the state being offered for this. A small school district like this to have to come up with that money in 1 year's time out of their budget would have had an incredibly detrimental impact on all the services they provide for their students. So appreciate this. This is a great way to address this and help our schools make these changes.
Thank you, Senator Rarick.
Senator Farnsworth.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't want to repeat everything that Senator Rarick said, but the Grand Rapids School District would be in the same situation where they would have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars that might push $1 million. And in 1995, they, in good faith, you know, wanted, before this was even a law, they wanted to change their mascot. And it just accidentally happened that they chose the Thunderhawks, and then they found out that, I believe somewhere in, well, we found out 2 years ago that somewhere in South Dakota there was a Chief Thunderhawk. But their logo has no Native American imagery. It's a bird. And so I really appreciate Senator Kunesh bringing this bill to allow them to go to the most local Native American tribe to get this exemption, because as a testifier said, we certainly don't want to spend state dollars to have them rebrand their school again 30 years later when we can save that money with a good partnership with their local tribe. So I just want to thank Chair Kunesh for bringing this bill, and I hope that we can see it in the final omnibus bill.
Senator Curran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe, I don't know if this is a question for the author or maybe the Grand Rapids representative that testified online, but I'm curious how Grand Rapids got even caught into this law, because from what I'm hearing, this just isn't a Native American mascot. There was no intention on their part. There's nothing in the logo indicating it. There may be was a chief in a different state, but that seems a rather tenuous link to this. So I guess, did Grand Rapids decide on its own that it fell under Section 1, Subdivision 2, the prohibition on American Indian mascots, and sought an exemption through the statute? Or did some other entity tell them they had to do that?
Senator Kunesh, do you want Mr. Cowan to answer that?
He can go ahead and answer, and then I can.
Mr. Cowan?
Sure. The reason that we were kind of caught up in this is that we were sent a letter by, I believe, the Department of Education to our superintendent.
Senator Curran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate that this bill, I think it's a positive development for the exemption process to get the exemption from the closest tribal nation to the school. That makes sense to me. I think that's an improvement. The cost that we've heard about, covering some of that, I think that's an improvement. But I think the fundamental problem still with this bill is that there's not a clear, maybe the definition is clear, but how the application of that definition is being applied doesn't seem to be working to me, because it's pulling in schools that don't have Native American nicknames and making them subject to this bill. To me, that's the fundamental problem. I don't think Grand Rapids should even have to go through the exemption process. And so if the Department of Education is putting its finger on the scales and saying that they believe that it applies, something is breaking down. And I don't know if it was the Department of Education itself that made that decision, or if it's the Tribal Nations Education Committee, or who exactly made that decision. But I don't think Grand Rapids should even have to go through the exemption process, nor the middle school down in Rochester that just has the name Bison. That, to me, is not a Native American nickname in and of itself either. And so it seems to me that there at a minimum should be a more transparent process with an appeals process for schools who don't believe they should even be subject to this statute to have some sort of recourse so that they aren't having to get an exemption. That's my comment, but I do think this bill makes the system better, but I don't think it goes far enough. Thanks.
Senator Kunesh, any remarks?
No.
All right. Any other comments or questions from members? All right. Seeing none, this bill is being laid over for possible inclusion. Senator Kunesh, did you have any closing remarks?
No. Just thanks for listening and, again, learning a little bit more and thinking a little bit deeper about the needs of our unique community of students in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. And this bill is laid over.
Thank you.
So next we're going to hear a couple of more bills about the mascot situation. Senator Kroon and, Farnsworth and Rarick both have brought me bills that I think are worth hearing and listening and discussing. So we'll have Senate File 81, that is Senator Rarick's bill, if you'd like to discuss it, or I don't know if you want to go up to the table, but feel free to discuss it as you please.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I gave the figures during the discussion of your bill, so I appreciate that opportunity. And I guess if we just, I would move Senate File 81 so it can be laid over for possible inclusion.
All in favor of laying over Senate File 81, say aye. Oh, I can just lay that over. Okay, I'm out of practice here. Okay, so Senate File 81 is laid over for possible inclusion. And then Senate File 349, do you have any comments that you'd like to make, Senator Farnsworth?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick, we drafted this bill in the event that the school district had to change their mascot, but we, in consulting the local school district, we would prefer for 1404 to be passed. But if that doesn't happen, then of course we would like my bill 349 to be passed, so that at least the school district that's made millions of dollars in cuts over the last couple of years doesn't have to find another somewhere between $800,000 and $1 million. But they stressed that they would prefer Senator Kunisch's 1404 bill. And this is just kind of an insurance policy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. So with that, Senate File 349 is also laid off over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Members, tomorrow we're going to be hearing four bills, Senate File 551, 2239, 2188, and Senate File 82. We are not planning to hold a hearing on Thursday. And with that, this committee is adjourned.